Welcome to Cyber Show 2025, Season 5. We're entering a new year in one of the most interesting and rapidly changing threat landscapes I've ever seen. We've got AI phishing bots dead ahead, a galactic-sized grey glue of slop approaching, quantum cryptanalysis on one flank, the insanity of biometrics and deepfakes on the other. We've enemies inside our telecom systems, spies inside our devices, and hardly a soul amongst us who can resist the scourges of greed, efficiency, convenience, and ignorance that keep us from real strength and security. Can we hold out against the forces of darkness? One powerful weapon we have is the law, and that's where we're starting with this episode. Will the law work for us against the greed of intellectual laziness that leads to poor cybersecurity? Or will regulation be friendly fire that will wipe out our last hopes of resistance to the empires and fiefdoms of total monopoly? Helen spoke to two on-the-ground representatives of the Compliance Order earlier.
Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of The Cyber Show. I'm here with Luke and Sam, who are from ISMS Online, and they're going to talk to us all about regulation with the 27001 DORA and 42001 as well, as many more. And we're looking forward to chatting to you guys. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's late to have you.
Very kind of you. Thank you, Helen.
So you want to just explain a little bit about why are we discussing compliance today?
Yeah, so ISMS Align is a global information security management platform, ultimately built for very different purposes a long time ago before my time, but actually not too far before your time in the business, Sam. But how it's evolved is to kind of embrace this compliance journey that's been going on and the digitization of compliance, especially over the last 5, 6, 7 years. We work with thousands of companies all around the world, supporting them in managing their information security management in the best possible way, saving them time, money, resource, etc. On a topic that's not particularly always got high confidence and capability or even discipline sometimes as well. So we're the leading 27001 platform globally.
Organizing the unorganized, some might say.
That's a bit what Sam does with me, I think, often. So.
Cybersecurity sometimes in a nutshell, that line.
Right, welcome both of you to the Cyber Show. Brilliant to have you here, Sam and Luke, and thanks for being our guests. In this episode, we've got distinct missions. One is a review of 2024 and maybe making a few predictions for the coming year, 2025. And then we'd like to have a bit of a discussion on the values and safety of new technologies and the role of compliance in making sure that that goes well for us all, the futures, markets, and with respect to what's going on the world stage politically and in terms of ethics. So without any further ado, Sam, if you'd like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what your work is with ISMS.
Sure. Thanks, Andy. Yeah, so I'm Sam Peters. I'm the Chief Product Officer here at ISMS Online. So I look after the development of the ISMS Online application, but I'm also our sort of senior risk owner here and our data protection sort of lead as well. So I cover all of that kind of information security, data protection side of thing within our business. I've been with the company for about, well, it'll be 12 years in January, so quite a while now. And when I joined, it wasn't an information security company. It was a company helping public sector collaborate. And over time, we increased the level of information we were processing, got into ISO 27001 through needing to comply with government contracts, and fallen into information security and compliance as our kind of speciality over that time as well. So it's been an interesting journey that finds me here today.
Lovely, thank you. Luke, you're with the same company. You have a different role.
Yeah, so I've been chief exec of ISMS Online for nearly 3 years now. Joined the business just over 4 years ago. I joined when commercially the business was in its infancy. And really my role was to globalize and internationalize the service that we provide and really take advantage of the information security upward curve that was taking place. And we've seen huge amounts of growth over the past 3-4 years, to the point now where we're a relatively large software business and operating in 30 different countries now. So we've got quite a kind of broad spread as well. And I'd say we're definitely one of those businesses that's predominantly linked to 27001, kind of what we're known for as the market leader within that space for information security management.
We're seeing more and more regulation coming in. It's really exploded in the last couple of years, I think. From the general public's point of view, it's more visible because we're seeing regulation coming into areas like social media, the kind of software that we're exposed to every day on mobile phones and those sorts of systems. In your experience, how effective is regulation by governments when it comes to technology?
My view on regulation is that it's a lagging sort of trend, right? It's always going to be behind the industry curve because the technology, the businesses are going to move much faster than any government and lawmaker can in terms of developing a consensus to build a set of regulations. So what we're seeing with regulation coming through is basically a baseline that is gradually moving up over time of what is acceptable from technology. So I don't think that the flux, as you sort of suggest it might be, of regulation at the moment reflects, kind of where we are now. I think it probably reflects where we were 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah. We're likely to see that continue.
It's almost like, you know, that's kind of the minimum bar, right? Yeah. You know, it certainly doesn't kind of reference industry leading standards.
One of the tensions that exists always is between innovation and safety. And I've certainly lived through an epoch in which there's really been no regulation. It's a laissez-faire system, certainly starting in the 70s, 80s, 90s. If you can build it, then build it. And, you know, the old maxim, well, just because you can doesn't mean you should, has never applied. So we've had this fantastic explosion, a true revolution, many of them, one after another, for four decades. We're suddenly seeing the chickens coming home to roost, as it were, with lots of areas where the accumulated dangers and technical debts and socio-political debts are all piling up. And we're seeing some very scary things happen. Do you think that regulation is able to meet those challenges, given the, you know, as you said, the sluggishness of the legal system and the political culture around it? Is it all too little, too late?
I would certainly say that having regulation is better than having no regulations. And even if, for example, those regulations are often found to be playing catch-up, I think that it's better to have governance and control to a minimum level, at least, with this sort of stuff, because often we don't always see the kind of fallout straight away from some of these things coming in, right? It sometimes can be further down the line. I think it's important to make sure that we are taking regulation and governance seriously.
I think it's not all doom and gloom in the sense that this technological progress that we're seeing through things like, you know, artificial intelligence or whatever other new technology is coming along are actually helping us drive forward. And basically, it's just a case of society managing a change, whether that's the internet revolution of 2000, whether that's the industrial revolution of the century before or whatever, it will change how that society operates and works. So you can't rely on government to define what that's going to be. There has to be a kind of consensus across the industry as well. We live in a free market world where people make money through success, through selling things that people are interested in. I think that's what's driving a lot of progress here. And I don't think that we should look at it all as being negative necessarily.
No, that's a very good point. We'll come back to that point, if you might, Sam, on what people are interested in. That is itself a very interesting question. With regard to innovation, when regulation comes along and we've got this situation where suddenly we want to put the brakes on a lot of things, there's a systematic problem here. You can't just put the brakes on innovation. And in a way, what you're hoping is that the innovation is going to get you out of a lot of the problems that you've caused. You know, I know we call this solutionism, where, you know, you've got a problem and now your next solution actually is just more of the same. But this is a real bind. It's a really difficult problem. So when it comes to compliance and regulation and so on, how do we best go about balancing safety and regulation with innovation? Carrots and sticks. I'm kind of becoming of the opinion that the sticks are not that effective. That, you know, I won't call compliance theatre, as some people have, because it's not theatre. There's obviously effect. But we're seeing within the free market that companies are simply writing in the financial costs, the huge fines, no matter how big they are, into the budget. Kind of like how if you're filthy rich, you don't have to worry about parking on double yellow lines, right? Just you've already got that in your budget. I'm going to have to pay for how many parking tickets this year. Yeah. So with that kind of attitude out there, well, what incentives, what are the carrots instead of the sticks? Do you chaps have any ideas about that kind of thing?
I think that some of the best incentives are around supply chain and being able to be, you know, on supply chains with large enterprise businesses, et cetera, if you have a kind of, you know, a good level of information security management, that is a kind of reward. I would say that's more carrot than stick, because all the opposite effect of if you do not show good security posture, that you aren't able to kind of participate in those sorts of trades through supply chain. So I think that the responsibility kind of starts with us as businesses, especially the larger organizations that kind of dictate a lot of this. So, you know, set the tone around this. I think that there's a good opportunity to create reward for taking this stuff seriously.
If you look at something like GDPR and the move around privacy, kind of came in sort of 6-7 years ago or whenever it was, what you were seeing there was a reaction to people kind of being profligate with data that they held on individuals. So regulation there was trying to raise awareness in the general community as well as regulate what businesses are actually doing. I think your average consumer probably thinks a lot more about their data and privacy now than they did sort of 4 or 5 years ago. And that's probably as a reaction to regulation forcing industry to change. So there are sort of net positives from this.
I hear an interesting point there, Sam, with regards to regular folks, the public's perception of regulation. People did not value their data, and to some extent they still don't, but at least now they're aware, you know, when something happens on your computer, on your phone, and it seems egregious, you feel like you've been conned or whatever, well, is that okay? Is it okay that companies can do that? And I think for a long time, people have just not known. It's just, well, they did it, presumably it's within the law, it's okay. That definitely did change with privacy. It continues to change. With the many other aspects of abusive technologies, there's a kind of interesting question there. Is you say that the function of regulation is also informative, is educational. It's to raise awareness of what is okay amongst the public. How do you think that that can be helped? And do you see more of that happening? And maybe what are the things that will come onto the general public's radar in 2025 as issues they should be aware of?
Take something like children and social media, or children and smartphones. You know, there's a very sort of pertinent topic at the moment, and I'm in the Luddite camp on this one. And my 12-year-old isn't allowed a smartphone at school, but he's one or two amongst thousands that doesn't. Yeah. Yeah, I think you've got a whole society that is waking up to some of the challenges that new technology has presented to them. So there's great benefits in terms of collaboration, communication, being able to access information, but the challenges of isolation, or being isolated when things happen to you through, you know, abusive text messages, whatever it might be, even if that's unintended, we're starting to see that impact ripple through. And we're starting, as adults who have grown up with some level of that technology — I didn't have a smartphone as a child, but you know, as adults that have kind of grown up and seen the rise of that technology, we're learning how to, you know, work with our children around that and develop an understanding as parents and as, you know, responsible grown-ups to the next generation about how we can manage it. But I think it's, you've almost got to learn mistakes to learn what you can do better next time.
I think as well, Sam, even in just general business, there's been a bit of a paradigm shift internally. You know, I remember 10 years ago, phishing emails going around and people almost mocking them and finding it amusing, you know, pinging it around each other. Well, I've had that one, you know. There's definitely been a shift now in how serious people take things, even something as kind of probably we'd say outdated now in phishing emails. And, you know, and I know we've moved over to a lot more kind of sophisticated ways of, but I think that, you know, even within business, kind of from a bottom-up perspective, people are more acutely aware of the dangers of it and are actioning that more appropriately.
Another new word, this time coming from academic and political circles, alignment. Do technologies still align with the broad needs and hopes and desires of humanity? Or are we all wandering off into the long grass of possibility without a compass of utility or a map of humanity? Well, I think we all get very, very excited about possibility. It's always been in the culture of technology since I was a kid, is that the new things are always great. We all conflate the notion of technology with progress, but we don't ask progress in what direction or progress towards what end. The stakes get higher, and things like global outages that take out basically most of the net for days at a time, serious looming resilience issues. Are people, do you think that people are shifting in their culture and perception of technology generally? That there seems to be a lot of techno doom around in so many areas, especially from the mass media, that maybe doesn't quite get the nuance of the technical issues, very black or white. Either it's going to take over the world and destroy us, or it's going to be our savior. In psychology, we call that splitting. It's where everything becomes black and white. It's very polarized. It's either or. What do we do to restore the nuance, maybe?
When you look at something like artificial intelligence, and you sort of touched on there, like, just because you can doesn't mean you should, what are we actually aiming for? There probably isn't a common cultural view of what you're trying to aim for with technology, is there? Is there's a group of individuals that are doing things because they find it an interesting problem to solve, or they're sort of fulfilling that human need to make life easier. Essentially, people are lazy and looking for the opportunity to spend less time doing the things that they do and more time doing the things they enjoy. So a lot of innovation has been based around that sort of idea. So I don't think that there is any kind of guiding star or guiding metric here that we can look at across all technology and say, why isn't everyone aligned with that? We might have a certain view as a Western affluent society that might be completely different from someone else's. You know, it's all culturally derived in that sense. So I don't think there is a hope for a unified view and response of humanity to technology. You also touched on the idea of resilience there. Well, actually, what we're starting to see is a huge range of interoperable parts across multiple providers, distributed globally and updated irregularly, that mean there's one moving part in an overall chain that can take something out, as we saw with CrowdStrike and then Microsoft outages, DDoS failure and so on this year. You know, it's that kind of reliance on very specific bits of a technology supply chain is increasingly difficult to manage.
Yeah, that is a big worry, isn't it? And things like, as a global security situation gets worse, attacks on submarine cables and things like that happening. So not only do we have the kind of background error rate and misfortune to contend with, but we have malice to contend with as well. The idea of alignment raises more questions. Alignment with who? Alignment with what values? Alignment with what cultures? And so on. Maybe the question then becomes, who is in control? Technology brings power, and power brings various actors who exercise control. And during the period of kind of libertarian capitalism of the last 40 years, power has been handed over to the market, the big tech companies that make things. And that what we're seeing politically now is an attempt by governments to reassert their power, which they've lost a little bit. Does that make any sense to you? Or do you think there are other factors behind what's going on?
I guess the interesting thing there is we're looking at this through a tech lens, but you could look at this through any other big business lens. You could look at this through an oil fuel lens as well, if you wanted to. If you've got big funding behind you, you can influence overall regulation and policy. I think my view of what we're seeing around regulation on things like privacy, resilience, and artificial intelligence is actually about governments protecting the free market trade rather than necessarily protecting individuals within it. Because by protecting the individuals, the benefit is that actually you can have a sort of safer operating environment in which businesses can flourish, rather than everyone feeling like they're kind of in a Wild West saloon and they're about to get shot up sort of thing. So it's that idea that government's actually creating a better environment for business, rather than just thinking about protecting its own interests and the interests of its individuals.
I like that, Sam. Let me just put that into my own words, is that, you know, good fences make good neighbours. And in a sense, constraints, they're always good in the arts. If you have an absolute free hand, you're not really quite sure what's okay and what's not. And the question becomes, well, what can I get away with? I think when there's clear guidance, and I think accessible, clear regulation, that is a help to business. It sort of levels the playing field a little bit. Do you think that the new AI guidance, is it helpful at the moment? I mean, let's move on to talk about that a little bit, because it's crept up on us and it's suddenly there. I don't think many people are aware that are working in tech that within a year we're going to have volume of regulation on what you can do with AI.
I think that it is a really positive shift because of the responsibility on businesses when it comes to AI. We all know the kind of benefits of that technology and how it makes huge amounts of, you know, upside for businesses, etc. But also on the flip side of it, it's such a danger to kind of people and businesses as well. So I think that something had to be done just because of the pure kind of extent of AI's reach within businesses. It's a really, really positive move to give it some governance, give it regulation. And also the way that it's aligned to 27001, I think, is a real positive as well, you know, being the internationally recognized standard as well. So you talk about that alignment piece and having a kind of common agreement on what good looks like. I think that with so much of it aligned to 27001, that's also quite positive.
Yeah, I think it's we talk about like regulations being a kind of lagging trend, and standards essentially, while not necessarily always written in that way, tend to end up as a way of demonstrating compliance against the regulation. So you've got 27701, the data privacy standard, which essentially is a kind of a certification you could get that demonstrates a level of GDPR compliance. You've got 42001 that's come out that is a way of demonstrating a level of compliance with the EU AI Act, and 27001 could be seen as a way of demonstrating compliance with things like the national infrastructure NIS2 sort of NIS1 kind of approach as well. So I feel like they're always going to be inherently, you talked about them being vague, there's always going to be an inherent level of that, because you're talking across an entire industry, you're talking across an entire geography. In ISO standards, you're talking about a global standard that then needs to be delivered by an organization. So you can only be so prescriptive. And there are other standards out there if you do want to get into this setting has to be this and this setting has to be that. When you're thinking about a management system standard, like all of these ISO ones, it's actually about what sort of governance do you have as a business? How are you thinking about this subject matter? We always talk about the importance of your organizational culture when you're looking at a standard from ISO. So 27001 information security, what is your organizational culture around security and how do you embed that and grow that?
Sponsored by Billica Cybersecurity, maintaining digital realms.
Ethics, a word that leads us into a connection with the two things we've just talked about. One is the granularity of control, and the other is culture and ethos within the company or an organization that's trying to implement this stuff. Wherever we see regulation that's very specific, such as the NIST standard for passwords, which was recently revised to kind of put right about four decades of a bad practice in InfoSec, very prescriptive password rules that were so often the bane of administrators and everybody because they were over compliance and they were misinterpreted and so on. The granularity is just too fine. And the opposite is where it's just too vague and hand-waving, and we have, you must do nice things and sing kumbaya, broad ethical framework. And my experience of the word ethics, not of ethics, but the word, as a ethical hacker, someone who's taught many ethical hacking classes and worked on syllabuses of it and so on, is that ethics makes no appearance whatsoever. It's kind of like the mystery character that's off stage. There's no John Stuart Mill. There's no Jeremy Bentham. There's no Kantian posture. Ethics is just not there. It's a word which is thrown in, if you like, to sweeten, make the course name a little bit less prickly for parents that are going to send their kid to university to study hacking. Hacking? No, it's ethical hacking, Dad. Okay, right. So it can be a bit of an empty word in practice. And we see things like Google getting through, I don't know how many now, three chief ethicist officers. They make this appointment, and corporate ethics is, I think there's a lot of theatre there. You make these appointments, people step up, they say, I'm going to help do all of this, and it's all going to be ethical. Within 6 months, they hand in their notice because they realise they've been handed a poison chalice, really. And the problem there, I suspect, is it's just too loose and hard to interpret. And any way that you do interpret it, you meet resistance. I guess the question I'm getting to is, like, where is the sweet spot? And you chaps have a lot of experience with compliance and regulations from a pragmatic point of view. How do you think we find the sweet spot?
Yeah, I feel like too much detail is pretty easy to understand. And the more detail you have, the more often you're going to have to update that standard. So you look at the sort of lifespan of something like ISO 27001, previous version in 2013, next version in 2022. Actually, you have a standard that was broadly applicable for about a decade. Whereas if you have a highly prescriptive standard and this rate of change you've got in technology means you're unlikely to be able to keep up with that, which means there's constant changes, things that make it difficult to manage. So I think you will always see a number of these standards coming out in a fairly general way until you can reach a point of industry consistency around the approach, like with passwords. You know, for ages here in the UK, the NCSC advice was you don't have to change your passwords regularly. And when we had customers asking us about our password policy and we said we didn't change it, we had to like point them at the advice so they could understand that actually things had moved on since something they read in 1974. So I think there will always be a level of genericism in the standards that come out because it enables them to remain applicable. And then the auditor, the job of the auditor is to make that relevant to today.
The only thing I would add to that, the culture of a business adopting information security management, you know, and how much you need your people, your assets to actually immerse themselves and actually be on the same page and paragraph as your scope and the way that you set out, the way that your business is going to operate from an information security management perspective. So almost kind of audit to one side, the level of detail versus kind of its ability to be adopted by a business is a kind of real kind of nuance. And I think, Andy, you mentioned sweet spot. I think that's bang on the money, really, because, you know, if it's too complex, if it's too difficult for the people within the business, then it loses a lot of its value. And, it, you know, as we know, things like 27, it's not a box-ticking process, right? You know, it is around the entire company, top-down, bottom-up, immersing themselves in that culture of information security.
That's great, Luke. I'm really pleased to hear that. I have not been myself involved in auditing, but I do know a couple of auditors, and they tell me about their day-to-day experience being the people that don't get it. The ones that don't get it see it simply as a checklist, as a box ticking exercise, and they're very, very nervous and worried that they haven't complied with the letter of the law, etc. Not realizing that what's really going on there is that the auditor is trying to hold you to the values that you've said that you adopt. So if you've said, well, we have this procedure and that procedure, well, do you follow that procedure? Do you do all these processes that you say you do? And if so, great. And if not, well, don't worry, but do you have a roadmap to put those processes in place, etc.? How much of your work is helping people understand compliance culture, if you like?
3 years ago, I started to get more involved in our actual ISO 27001 certification process. Prior to that, it was led by yourself, Sam, and a few others, etc. But when I was made chief exec, I thought it was the right move to kind of show the initiative and to show the value that I attached to it. So I got super involved in it. And I can still remember one of the proudest moments of that kind of audit process. It wasn't how beautifully laid out our information security management information was, which it was, by the way, but it wasn't how that was. It was actually at the point where ad hoc, randomly, at any point, the auditor just wanted to call certain individuals that they hadn't prepped in the business. And every single person in our organization covered themselves in glory, you know, and if they didn't know the exact answer, they knew where to find it and stuff like that. And I thought that was a really telling moment for me that, yes, you know, obviously we drink our own champagne with this sort of stuff, but actually it is not a box ticking process and our people don't view it as a box ticking process. It was kind of a bit of a come to Jesus for me in and around, you know, kind of the value that actually 27001 can bring to businesses, if that makes sense.
Yeah, very, very much so. My next question then would be, how do you get buy-in? I mean, how do you prepare the ground to get buy-in? I mean, that's a big ethos with our stuff that we do with Boudica Cybersecurity. Yeah. We do not want to be the headmaster coming to a group of naughty school children who've been put on the naughty step already because they did something like click a phishing email. Yeah. If you can't obtain buy-in, you're sunk. And what question that I encounter quite often is, well, you know, whose say-so is this? Where does this come from? Where does regulation come from? People don't know about the background of standards organizations, of the origins of the debate in, the European Commission, that bills have to go through Parliament, that legislation has to be drafted, that, you know, and speaking as a Briton in the post-Brexit wreckage, you can see the culture of this rejection of who are they to tell us what we should and should not do of our own company here.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of the ethical arguments about, well, obviously this would be better if we did things this way. It would be safer. It would actually be for our own good. And that problem that when people examine laws, they often do so on the back foot and not realizing actually this is there to protect me and people like me and my family and my loved ones. Is there still a culture of resistance in compliance? And if so, where do you think it comes from?
You kind of touched on how do you get people to buy in, Andy, just now. And you know, there's obviously a myriad of different ways in which you can kind of engage your people within a business to kind of buy into the information security management posture that you have. I think two areas that we found really big success is first of all, leadership leading by example and setting the tone. And it not being a, you must do this, do as I say, not as I do. You know, we have a kind of a really strict policy on the leadership team to be kind of leading by example at all opportunities. And I think that when kind of off-piste away from compliance for a second, when people see leaders driving and passionate about something, that's half the time what they want in a workplace is to have direction and have someone to follow and have someone to kind of look to. So I think that if you can channel that, that's a really good starting point. And I suppose the other point where I think that we've seen particularly, because we've grown quite quickly as a business, right? So 4 years ago, we were a 20-person organization. We're now four times that as a company. And when you bring new people in, that's a constant process of kind of making sure everybody's bought into this culture. So I think that one of the big ways in which we've really had success with that as a business, and we've seen our clients have success, is educating our people on the why, not just the what you need to be doing, but the why it's important. And we run, you know, regular sessions with our people talking through various different examples of how to do things, you know, all these sorts of stuff, and just to giving people that kind of constant education process. So if you can combine the top-down leadership with constant education process, it doesn't necessarily mean you've solved it all in a day, but I think that you'll be in a good position to kind of build on a healthy foundation.
Great points there, Luke. Sam, do you want to follow up on any of those?
Yeah, well, just quickly to say the sort of the why, I think if you can relate that to an organization, you can show that the organization that these policies are there to protect not only you as individuals within the organization, but to enable the organization's success as well. The big scary fines that people talk about around GDPR that we probably haven't seen materialize hugely, but were there. You know, that was a big risk for business, and you don't want to get your business wiped out because of some data protection leak. So showing that this stuff is protecting your business and protecting your job as well helps people understand that. And the other thing I'd just add to Luke's, you know, how do you embed the sort of zero blame approach as well, right? People are going to make mistakes. It's all about learning and improving. So making sure that your company is encouraging an environment where people want to report stuff that might not be right, so you've got an opportunity to fix it.
So run us through some of the big issues that we've seen in 2024. So you can start with AI's first major kill.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an interesting piece here where an organization has basically lost all of its value as a result of AI coming along and eating its lunch, in the sense that I think it's the first of many this will happen to. In this case, it was something that can easily be generated by Gen AI. You know, so anyone in the learning industries or the kind of creative writing industries, I think, is probably facing quite a challenging year in 2025 as a result of this coming along, Gen AI in general.
Absolutely. We're seeing quite a few issues with AI so far because we're hearing stories every week. Just last week, we found out that the voice recognition systems, banks and financial services can quite easily be manipulated by AI.
Yeah, the rapid evolution of large language models is definitely contributing to that. And as people start to understand it more, I think, you know, we're still at a point where there's a whole group of people that just don't know how to use AI yet and haven't seen anything from it. As that sort of generation starts to kind of get to grips with it, this will accelerate more and more, I think.
It reminds me of a conversation that I had back in only 2022, I think it was, with an architect of a big company who said that AI was not something that he saw coming into fruition. I think within 6 months, he was already implementing preventing against AI attacks. So, I mean, how do we get that message out to people who haven't been in study for 20 years and who are working in the field?
I've done quite a few interviews this year in and around things like deepfakes and AI, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the overriding thing to mention is it's not something on the horizon. It's not something that's coming. It's not something that's close. It's something that's here right now, and we're living in it. I think that's the kind of overriding thing for me.
I'm a little skeptical. I don't think we're all going to be replaced by robots. A bit like the internet, right? AI is a tool. How do we make the best use of it to service it? I do think it is going to be challenging, certainly for anyone that's in
creative space.
Yeah, AI podcasts now, although I hear they're not up to snuff yet.
They're absolutely awful. So we've also had Cloudflare this year has reported an unprecedented scale of DDoS attacks over 2024.
Yeah, I think we're seeing the ability of people to kind of mobilize large scale DDoS attacks being weaponized a lot more, whether to make a political point, part of a sort of nation state act in response to kind of global situations around conflicts that are taking place. It seems to be that they're hitting harder, hitting quicker, and taking out pointed targets as they go. A whole load of shopping sites on Black Friday, for example. So yeah, it's definitely something for us to watch out for. Even the Microsoft issue where it was misconfigured and amplified the attack as a result. You know, these are huge challenges that organizations are facing. And I think everyone needs to be prepared for a DDoS. It's just out there.
Yeah, we see these huge shutdowns across businesses. You know, we've had situations where we're working absolutely fine because we don't use Microsoft systems. We do security, so we can just migrate to a different server. But you find these huge companies are just completely crippled because they don't have the ability to move on. And you have things like Lindos. So there is the ability to help those users if they're not good in other operating systems. There are systems around that, but we don't see people taking that up. And it does make you wonder, is this continues to grow into 2025 and we do see these large scale DDoS attacks and system errors, are we going to find companies that have alternative means so that they can get around it?
These huge monocultures like CloudStrike and so on, where you've got tens of thousands of machines running exactly the same operating system, that is itself a real weakness. And these giant attacks, which are designed to leverage that monoculture, we see more and more of that. And it would be great to see if we can achieve resilience through diversity, getting more different kinds of systems running. Not quite triple modular redundancy, but you know, it's almost as if you need to have a complete mirror, a complete separate backup system running maybe on OpenBSD or some other operating system that you can flip over to when your main system gets owned.
It's definitely something that is a luxury for some organizations to have. To have a skill set that allows you to operate across a diverse environment means hiring different engineers or upscaling your existing engineers to be able to support that. So every company is going to be weighing up that risk and cost as they go, aren't they?
I find as well that often the excuse is, oh, well, the IT team or the users can't use anything else. And so there is this huge, we've all heard that. Oh, we can only use that. They're not skilled enough. And you think, well, why are the skills that a business is requiring not available in the market? And how do we approach that at the educational level as well?
It's hard enough just to keep on top of one vendor's product, you know, with the complexity of IT systems now. But to have stakes in multiple operating systems, multiple ways of doing things is a very tall order. But I do agree. Education is absolutely foundational in this. And we advocate very strongly principles, not products. Say in DNS configuration, to understand in a much more fundamental way, what is DNS? How does it work? How are the records structured and so on? Not simply learning one management tool. And then when that management tool gets broken by an attack or whatever, you can flip over to something that looks like it, and you're immediately comfortable. That would be a great ideal. I wonder to what extent do compliance and regulations help to mandate diversity of knowledge?
Yeah, I think that if you look at a standard, take for example, ISO 27001, how it differs to other information security standards that are out there in the world is that it is definitely driven by culture, top down, bottom up. It isn't a box-ticking process. It isn't an evidence collection process. The auditor is intrinsically interested in what would this individual do if this happened. And the entire process, not just the process of kind of building your information security management system, but also them educating your people on the value of it and making it part of company culture, then also through to the actual 3-, 4-, 5-day audit that you do with the auditor as well. All of that combines to kind of an overriding effect of these things are embedded and do get embedded. And that is why something like 27001 is the gold standard and the one that everybody looks to, because it's not easy. It's not easy to get people to buy into this, because it's not sexy. It's not, you know, not particularly fun, right? But ultimately, that entire process, it does kind of drive that importance.
And if you look at things like the NIS2 and the DORA regulations that are coming in, all of these things are putting the idea of resiliency and redundancy in front of people and making them think about it. So whether you're working through a control set from 27 or you're looking through the implementation guidance around those regulations, all of that is making a business think about, okay, well, what do I do if, what do I do when? And that's just putting it in the forefront of people's minds means we've got more opportunity to consider it, which probably also means people will release more products that help enable it and support it as well, right? So it's a sort of self-sustaining and fulfilling.
In terms of DORA, actually, we went to the BCS event with the finance leaders. So it was a nice, strange joint event between cybersecurity leaders and financial leaders from the banking industry. And they sat on one side of the room and we sat on the other. And it became quite a heated debate, I'd say, where the bank said, well, why should we implement DORA? The fine's not a much, it seems to follow the GDPR. What's the difference? Why do we have to keep implementing all these different things? And we're trying to sit there saying, well, you know, this, if you want to trade in Europe, then you're going to need to follow it. And a lot of the time they say, well, if we just follow this one standard, surely it covers everything. It can do, but it depends which one you choose. So I think there's a lot of pushback in terms of which regulations that they should take on board. But it does certainly get them thinking about it, you know, discussing it. It's very important, I think.
Definitely. And I think that over the last 4 years that I've been in within compliance, I've started to see a shift of businesses being one standard specific. And now, you know, especially the mid-market and larger organizations, they're starting to embrace the fact that we might need to be looking at multiple different standards. And Sam, we've seen it with our business in the way that our product kind of is sat. And is it a one standard platform, or can you manage multiple standards in it? And, you know, how does that work and all of that sort of stuff? So I think we're certainly on a journey with that, but it's certainly, I think people are opening their eyes to it.
We've seen the EU bring in the Artificial Intelligence Act, which I believe is after we implemented some rules on artificial intelligence. And obviously companies are going to have to start putting some implementations in who are using that sort of thing. And they've only really got until the 2nd of August 2026 with some prior work in by the 2nd of February 2025. So our business is going to be sort of doing a mad rush now to get into that standard, to follow that, that are using AI across Europe, or are we still going to find a few stragglers that are not complying and some trouble in that area?
I think it's a really interesting one, because you had that kind of mad cattle rush with GDPR where everybody panicked at the last minute and thought, oh my God, you know, I need to do something about that. It doesn't feel, you know, on the ground that that is the way that 42001, but I might be wrong on that. But what I would say is I spend quite a lot of time with partners in the US. It's certainly getting noise in the US for those US businesses that want to be working with European businesses. The US are taking it pretty seriously, especially some of the audit bodies over in the US as well. And that's always a good sign. I think there are countries that are further ahead, Germany, for example, than other countries within Europe. Usually Germany are ahead on these sorts of things. It won't necessarily be that kind of mad rush, but I do believe it's going to really upkick over the coming sort of 6 months, 12 months, as more and more people jump on this and realize they need to do something about it. So I think that although it won't be as crazy as GDPR, I think it'll certainly be fun.
There's a lot of crossover with existing sort of standards and regulations in what's being asked through the EU AI Act. You know, if you think about things like under GDPR, you're talking about automated decision making, you know, so you're processing a large set of data. How are you making decisions against it? Well, okay, that's some of the machine learning that will be part of an AI system potentially. So you're already kind of thinking about how you're managing decisions. You're already thinking about how you're managing personal data, because, you know, what am I putting into the system? Does it have names, email addresses? Is it identifiable? And then you're already thinking about security through things like ISO 27001, NIS, DORA, and all of that stuff. So it's more the application of artificial intelligence rather than the kind of baseline of security and privacy that organizations will already have covered. So it's that kind of delta that they'll be looking at. probably smaller organizations that are going to have to think more than larger ones that already have a process in place.
And thinking of regulation as well, you mentioned the US. Obviously, we have seen a call for more regulations, for stricter regulations of data, of AI. But we've now, America are sort of moving away from that. If we look at what things like Elon Musk are saying in public, they are saying that they want to move away from regulation to increase economic growth. What does that do to their security or the security of the world if they decide to move away from more regulation? You know, are they going to be able to trade with Europe? Are we going to have to segregate?
They'll probably do enough to keep business going, won't they? It's a big market. You can do well just serving the US, but I think you want to serve Europe and other markets as well. So what Europe does will in some sense govern what US companies need to do. Removing regulation almost completely in the US, deregulation is probably the approach that's more likely in the next presidential period.
Going to move on now to themes of the year, so disinformation and elections. So what do we think about the foreign interference that was suggested in the 2024 elections? What do we think about that, and how is that going to shape our world?
What I would say is that it didn't surprise me to be reading it. It wasn't something that I was like, oh, I can't believe it. I think that it was almost inevitable that it would have an impact. Nobody knows what the future is going to be like. It wouldn't surprise me if that was just also another common theme of politics, elections, etc., that I think that will evolve in its own way. I struggle to see how that can be limited.
I think probably as long as there's been elections, there's people been trying to influence elections. what are you going to do? You buy in the votes openly. Maybe even seeing that happen again these days. But the idea that you can make a post that sort of changes someone's entire political view, I think is quite interesting, because we've seen some of the challenges around shifting conspiracy theory viewpoints for individuals, and this idea that actually if you try and present the alternative argument, they're going to reinforce their view. So there's obviously some quite good psychology that's gone into those posts that perhaps, you know, might filter down into some better choices beyond nudge theory sort of thing.
Do you know what surprised me the most is in our election, people weren't engaging with it as much. In the social media platforms that we have eyes on, I guess, because Telegram was a bit of a surprise. But I guess that we've done quite a lot in the UK, especially with children, to actually educate them about misinformation and disinformation. And that brings us really back onto Australia, and they've done the same thing, and they've banned social media just outright for children so that they can stop those messages coming in while their brains are still developing. What do you feel about that? And should we spread that out across the whole world? Is that what we should be doing?
I wouldn't let my kids on social media yet. I mean, I also am not on social media myself, so I'm definitely I'm not unique, but I'm definitely different than most in that sense. The most important thing is to teach kids how to rationalize about what they're reading about and make a decision about whether it's true or not. I think if you go around outright banning stuff, that has some benefit in that you won't present those situations, but equally you won't teach children to deal with them and understand them and respond to them. So it's a both and situation. You know, I've got to give kids a level of freedom so they can make some mistakes, but you've also got to give them the boundaries to know how to be safe within that.
So I've got an 11-year-old and a 10-year-old, and all of their friends have got iPhones and are on social media, and I won't let them use it at all. It's like, please let me have it all the time. And I'm like, no, it's dangerous. And we explain why, but you're right, we have to expose them to it. And one of the things that I do is we sit there and we watch, you know, mad stuff on YouTube as a family, and I will pick it apart in the most scientific way possible. And they've grown up to realize that's social media is full of lies. But there are, you know, children who just read things and just believe it straight off the bat because they're not being exposed to it. And so there is definitely that fine balance that we need to walk.
I do joke about having young children and it kind of not being as relevant. But my four-year-old, for example, can't leave him with the iPhone alone for any moment because he'll be on TikTok or YouTube or one of the instantly.
And that's online banking.
That's my thing. <not here.
laughs> Never attach your card to your phone. We got a story as well of a friend who got a brand new iPhone and dropped it in a puddle because he was only 9. That's what happens when you give expensive kit to children, as it ends up in a puddle at break time. So what do we do when big tech starts to fall? Who's going to pick up the slack there?
I mean, given the points we've had about diversification of technology, is that the end of the world? I mean, I think these things move up and down, don't they? Intel's been dominant for years, and the chips that it's making and is now playing catch up. Even Nvidia's had some challenges this year compared to the boom growth they've had. I think, you know, we see a sort of cycle with these things where different businesses come through and are ascendant for a period of time, and then another one comes up to take their place. So I don't think we're moving away from the idea of there being some small group of companies that are going to be be more successful than others, but perhaps the chairs at the table are being swapped out.
You've seen that over the last 40 years, 50 years, you know, there's been Netflix or Blockbuster, or whatever it is, you know, all those sorts of examples of people being left behind. Everything's moving so fast. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We are seeing some of those big tech companies, they sort of join forces, essentially, to protect medium and smaller businesses. And I guess that's something that's new. And that's come from cybersecurity, from being attacked. We've now caused cooperation between competitors.
Yeah, and I think you probably have a situation where it's that sort of co-opetition sort of approach of like, how do we increase the value of the market? That means we've got more market to sell to. That means we can still profit even if we work together and share a bit of that profit. So don't know if it's all done completely from the point of view of altruism, but I guess it's about market stimulus.
You mentioned Intel there, and that was quite a shock this week to find the CEO is leaving. And we are seeing huge tech layoffs continue as well. So is the tech world maybe suffering more so than other industries, or are we just seeing that across the board at the moment with most companies?
I think that is a more generalist experience that businesses are. It's been a really tough year across the board. It's not been selective in who it affects. Confidence hasn't been high. I think that it's compounded sometimes with tech because of how successful they have been over the past 15 years. So it kind of stands out as a bit more of a wow moment.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a kind of global downturn in terms of several major conflicts taking place. There's been a US presidential election. I'd like to say that our general election probably had a minor effect here in the UK, but probably not massively internationally. But there's been a lot of change this year, all on a year that started on an uncertain footing anyway, with cost of living rising across the board. And now you've got things like additional tariffs in the US, potentially raising costs of consumer electronics and things like that. So I think there's going to be a theme that probably continues into 2025.
Are we also seeing some issues as well? You know, we look at Microsoft's nearly $29 billion in taxes, and they're doing layoffs as well. And if we look at Microsoft for the past 3 years, they were very much overspending as well, trying to launch their gaming platform, their streaming game platform. Is overspending in the tech world something to do with that?
Probably a lot of businesses taking a punt on a lot of different things, aren't there? I mean, Microsoft may all pay out by virtue of their ownership of OpenAI in the future. You know, that could turn around and be the Hail Mary that saves them. But a lot of this is stimulating new environments for them to do business in, like Microsoft streaming services are new. You know, how do they stop building boxes that sit under people's TVs, but how do they keep the revenue coming in from Xbox games? You know, that's the sort of approach there. So it's a sort of transition time from how have they operated before to how are they operating again, you know. And Satya Nadella said that in his opening to shareholders about how have you stayed relevant for 5 decades in the industry by constant change and reinvention. So
I still remember I worked really closely with the managing director of BSkyB, and one of his comments was, I think it was relating to 2008, is that when that all happened, the thing that they did was they tripled marketing spend within that period, took more shots, took more punts while everybody was being more conservative. And I think people have learned from that actually when the chips are down, it's time to get the wallet out a little bit. You know, and I think that someone like Microsoft, they're able to do that because of the kind of stock that they've got.
Absolutely. And you can see that race with AI with those big companies as well. They're very aware that if they are left behind, it could be a huge change for them. So Luke, you've got some top trends on AI governance for us. So we'd like to look at predictions in 2025 of the new AI governance surge. What new standards and drive of ethics, what are we going to be looking at in 2025 in that regard?
Yeah, I think that, you know, businesses will face, you know, escalating demands for AI governance and compliance. That's 100%. And with frameworks like the AI Act setting the pace, I suppose the shift when companies go to adopt these frameworks for the AI risk management, etc., and ensuring that transparency, accountability, etc. So I think that the overriding thought around this AI piece is that businesses are going to be embracing it, going to be embracing it at pace. Probably isn't going to be a smooth journey for a lot of these businesses, but you know, the commitment is there.
Absolutely. And how do we go about driving organisations to comply with things such as the ISO 42001?
Yeah, we touched on it earlier around the carrot and stick strategy. Given the opportunity around AI, I think that there's much more opportunity for us to drive the carrot rather than stick approach on this. You know, regulation kind of always playing catch up a little bit, so that's always a really difficult thing. Ultimately, if businesses are taking seriously the AI Act of 42001, then, you know, through supply chain engagement, etc., we can reward that, right?
So when it comes to cyber insurance, is it a paradoxical effect? As companies have the insurance, they become less vigilant, take on less standards, or is it something that you see actually aiding and really helping those companies with their standards?
I think it's both and, isn't it, with cyber insurance? I mean, essentially, if you're thinking about what are you going to do with a risk that you've got, you're either going to treat it, you're going to tolerate it, you're going to transfer it. You know, what are those options? It's a transfer of risk to someone else. There are things that you might not be able to do yet that you want to insure against. There are things that you then might build out to reduce that level of risk and reduce your insurance overhead. I think, you know, insurance exists in all industries across all things. So I don't think we should be worried about people just offloading all of their cybersecurity risk to insurance, because premiums will go up and they'll be uninsurable.
I remember reading about the July outage. I think the insurance market cost expected was around $1 billion, which was 3 times more than any other in recent times. So there is value in it, but I agree with you, Sam. I think that, you know, people will be cautious with it, because very quickly these premiums can spiral and budgets become tighter and tighter. Tripling, quadrupling spend on cyber insurance is not an easy cost to absorb.
But I think it's part of a portfolio of our approach to management of risk. So the standards and standards compliance and regulatory compliance is one sort of arm of that, arm, leg, whatever. You know, insurance can be another.
Yeah.
If we now look into the 2025, especially the geopolitical landscape that we're in at the moment, are we likely to see governments further investing in safeguarding essential services, making sectors like energy, healthcare, finance more resilient, things like that? What are we going to see in 2025 in that regard?
I think that we will see governments driving this for sure. We're already seeing it, you know, with various different industries, etc. You don't have to go too far to be, you know, to be exposed to it through energy, for example. Going back to the compliance and regulation piece, is just going to come more of a day-to-day life because of how much risk is associated with stuff now. And so I don't know the effects that it will have on geopolitical stance, but I think that it certainly will be a new norm moving forward.
You start to think about us as an island nation. You know, we talked about the idea of underwater cables being cut. Well, there's a very real possibility that a coordinated move could leave the United Kingdom without any connection to the outside world, other than, you know, a satellite phone or whatever it is. So there's a level of planning that we've got to make around that I think governments will be interested in. If you look at stuff that here in the UK that the National Cybersecurity Centre's done with standards like Cyber Essentials and just general information awareness, there's a gentle push as well as the kind of regulatory pull to move organisations into a greater level of resilience. All of it, again, you know, if you come back to the kind of free market economics of it, is about the country making more money as a result of these businesses being more successful, which means more tax and so on. So that's the reason they want to try and cultivate this security approach and keep their garden maintained, as it were.
There has been a rise as well in critical national infrastructure attacks, and we've seen the NCSC get really on that almost immediately with advice and giving that away for free. It's really good that all those businesses that can't afford someone to come in are getting that information where it's needed, and it's really good that we can raise more money to deal with that. And I'm just sort of thinking now, are we going to get collaborations of nations? We're living in quite a mad time at the moment with lots of individual, very large-scale invasions and attacks and things. Are we going to see more European, UK, USA, Australia connection, and on the other side as well, are we going to start to see fragmentation of internet and resources and security policies?
I think we'll definitely see more collaboration. You can kind of hear it in the mood here in the UK at the moment around business leaders saying they're interested in more more collaboration with the rest of Europe. I think when you're potentially on different sides of a global conflict as well, that is something that will bring countries together. You look at something like the US-UK relationship, that's a little bit turbulent at the moment. From the US perspective, gives them a foothold in Europe that they wouldn't otherwise have.
We've been trolled by Elon Musk over the last couple of months since the election as well. He's certainly anti-UK, but I don't think he's quite worked out how that costs him and his country in terms of finance and security. And I believe he's just been elected as a government official, so I'm a little bit confused as to whether someone needs to update America on our close relationship or not. It does feel that way.
His department is named after a meme, though, so
yeah.
Welcome to our workplace cybersecurity training. Training with Boudica is a different experience. we offer very high academic quality, accessibility, flexible study, and high outcome impact. Our course is unique and specially built by an expert team of university professors to deliver the same standard of teaching you'd find at a top university, but condensed and tailored for beginners. If you're interested and want us to be part of your journey to better company cybersecurity, contact us at Boudica. We'd love to hear from you. Connect by following the links at the end of this video or visit our website, boudicasecurity.com, for more details.
Thank you so much, Luke and Sam, for joining us. Can you give us the contact information that our listeners can get in touch?
Yeah, if people want to check out what we're doing at ISMS Online, we've got a great blog feed on our website at isms.online. You can also find us on LinkedIn. We publish a whole load of articles there from us as a business and from industry-leading journalists as well. You can check out our Twitter account, or whatever it's called these days, at twitter.com/ISMS_online as well. So please check us out. Please follow us on LinkedIn. We've got loads of great information coming out on a weekly basis.
Thank you, guys, and goodbye for now.
Thank you so much, Helen. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, chaps.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity. Cheers.
Bye.